the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. We're celebrating Earth Day this hour with check-ins from three environmental researchers who update us on everything from sea level change and heat spikes to protecting one of the most endangered mammals on Earth. But first, this year's Global Earth Day theme is Planet versus Plastics. I'm here with Dr. Jack Kirkefox, research scholar in North Carolina State University's Department of Biological and Agricultural Engineering. He's a co-investigator on a project that tracks the amount of plastic found in the Neuse River Basin. Jack, thank you for joining us today. Welcome to Due South.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Plastics, man, they're pretty nasty, aren't they? You know, they make up the majority of all marine litter. So where is it all coming from, Jack?
So in terms of microplastics, it's really just the breakdown of mismanaged plastic waste, right? It comes from wastewater sources, agriculture, tire wear, manufacturing processes, and really just the breakdown and degradation of really the thousands of products we use in everyday life. So just to give a couple examples, right? You might be standing on carpet right now. That's a polypropylene-based fiber. And as we walk on it over time, it's breaking down and it's generating microplastic fibers. Another thing, a lot of shoes, right? As we're walking, our shoe soles break down. And that's the generation of microplastics as we're moving. Another example would be a lot of clothing these days is made of synthetic fibers, so polyester. And as we wash those clothes over time, it's generating plastic fibers as it breaks down. There's a lot of different sources. So, you know, single-use plastics, as those break down, shopping bags, just a lot of different sources. But a lot of it's coming from, right, these inland rivers. So it's generated in our urban areas. Then it moves down through rivers into the coastal environment where it is deposited and accumulates.
You know, sometimes when I think of plastic, I forget to think about what you just mentioned, you know, some clothes and carpets and things of that nature. I just think of those soda bottles, you know, that I see sometimes on the street and sometimes even at the beach, just floating around. So I guess, how do you get the word out to folks, you know, about this debris and these microplastics that you just spoke about?
Right. So yeah, plastic bottles, very common item that we find. And I think the way that we try to approach it is, you know, people tend to care more about something if it maybe has an effect on them or kind of a personal health effect. So, right, there's a lot of emerging research right now about microplastic having impacts on human health. So we didn't specifically look at that, but other researchers are publishing studies suggesting that microplastics are affecting the cardiovascular system, the respiratory system, the reproductive system, hormone production. So I think if we're able to communicate that, right, this plastic pollution over time, it's breaking down into microplastics, and then there is a, you know, end result of human health effects, I think that might be a potential way to increase awareness and maybe increase the number of people who are, you know, have an invested interest in reducing plastic pollution.
Like plastic can make you sick.
Yeah, essentially.
But we almost can't live with plastic or without plastic.
It's tough. So I always bring up the example, right? You go to the grocery store, and if you're not going to use plastic, it's pretty difficult to eat, right? It's, you know, everything is packaged in plastic. You have, you know, increasingly we see this kind of single, you know, items or individual packaging for single servings increasingly being used. So it's really pervasive in our society and in the environment at this point. So it's really going to take a concerted effort at, you know, looking at biodegradable alternatives as well as, you know, potentially looking at bans of certain items, single-use plastics and stuff like that to try and get a handle on this. Because right now, right, microplastics are pervasive in the environment. And those are kind of baked in. It's really difficult to remove microplastics once they're out in the environment. So it's thinking about, you know, future generations, can we reduce that accumulation? Because once they're in the environment, they're there for hundreds of thousands of years, right? So the more we're generating, the more it's building up. We need to think about reducing that future buildup because over time, right, the health effects are only potentially going to become more problematic.
So how much plastic really just ends up in our oceans every year? I know that's a big question and, you know, maybe we can't even conceptualize how much, but do you have an idea?
Yeah, so recent estimates, you're looking at, you know, several million tons per year of plastics accumulating in our oceans. So it is, you know, it's hard to really visualize that volume, but right, it is a significant amount that's entering every year.
And rivers supply a lot of this, I guess I can just call it trash, you know, that that reaches our coastal waters. So why are rivers, you know, such breeding grounds for that sort of refuse? I guess because we're closer to the rivers than we are to the oceans.
So if we think about when it rains on, right, in our environment, on, you know, pavement or landscaping, wherever it rains, that water has to go somewhere. So, right, it goes into curbs and gutters, it goes into our stormwater pipes, and then those pipes send the water to our local waterways, our small streams. Those flow to our larger streams, which go into our rivers. So ultimately, anything that's on our surfaces out in the environment is going to be washed into our storm drain system in urban environments, and then eventually find its way into our rivers. So people may not realize this, but anytime you litter, most likely it's going to end up in our waterways and then eventually in the ocean if it's not captured in some way.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about your research, A River of Plastics. It focuses on the North Carolina Neuse River Basin. Why did your team select that particular body of water?
Right. So the Neuse River Basin drains to the Pamlico Sound, which is the second largest estuary in the eastern United States. And it is a very important for fishing, right, particularly shellfish. And a lot of these important seafoods that exist there, oysters, for example, are filter feeders. So they are filtering the water as they're, you know, consuming organics and other stuff that's in it. And as they're doing that, they are accumulating microplastics in their bodies. And then when we potentially consume those different seafoods, right, it's potentially bioaccumulation through the food chain. So humans are being exposed to that. So, right, it was really an interesting watershed because we have this very developed urban area up in the Raleigh-Durham area. And then it drains down, you have more of an agricultural landscape as it moves down towards the coast. We were able to look at, you know, different areas and see if we could see a difference in where the microplastics were coming from in terms of rural versus urban areas.
Well, what are some of the most common microplastic types that actually are found in the basin?
Right. So most of the microplastics we found were polyethylenes. And polyethylene are a lot of, you think about plastic bags are a big one.
Like the ones from the grocery store?
Yeah, like a typical shopping bag you'd get at a grocery store. So those tend to, right, they're out in the sun or you know, in the river, and they're kind of being moved around and pummeled by, you know, the water and other things. And then the UV rays break them down and become brittle, and then they fragment into very, you know, tiny microplastics. So it's one of the fastest plastics to break down in terms of becoming microplastics. So that was one of the major ones we found. But also like plastic bottles, a lot of water bottles are polyethylene based. So, right, there's a lot of sources that we use in everyday life that can become those microplastics.
You know, that brings us to like which wildlife is really most susceptible, you know, to those plastic bags.
You know, if you're talking about as they've broken down into microplastics, it's going to be those filter feeders in the Sound or other fish. And then you're talking about, right, whatever species consume those those fish or your shellfish are can potentially have bioaccumulation. So you get a, you know, it the amount increases as you move up the food chain.
Well, I also wonder, how hard is it to clean up the river? And what can you tell our listeners about what they can do to help other than not dumping their trash on the ground?
Yeah, so once plastics are in the environment, it is extremely difficult to remove them. So we've done some other projects focused in Raleigh and on campus trying to capture plastic trash when it's in the river. And, you know, there's only a certain amount that you can capture. It's going under your device you're trying to capture it with or going over it during high flows. So we really need to focus on preventing it from getting into our waterways. And that is, right, essentially trying to reduce litter and reduce the generation of plastics into our environment. Because, like I said, once they're in the rivers, ocean, lakes, it becomes, you know, kind of overwhelming to try and remove those from the environment. So it really is about reducing the source of these, the plastic litter.
We just have to be better stewards of the earth, don't we?
That's what it comes down to, yeah.
Dr. Jack Kirkefox is a research scholar in North Carolina State University's Department of Biological and Agricultural Engineering. Jack, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely, Leonita. It's been a pleasure.
Well, up next, a temperature check on North Carolina's climate crisis with state climatologist Dr. Kathy Dello. You're listening to Due South. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of America. You're listening to Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. North Carolina is getting warmer, wetter, and more humid. Hurricanes are intensifying and flooding risks have increased. Scientists from across the state agree that the changes to our climate in this century will be larger than anything experienced in North Carolina's history. If you're wondering if there are any ways to better prepare for these changes or to slow down their impact, look no further than the North Carolina State Climate Office for research and recommendations. I'm here with state climatologist Dr. Kathy Dello. Kathy, welcome to Due South.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, we got a lot of questions for you. Definitely. I've noticed that in some more recent discussions, the term climate change is being replaced with the term climate crisis. You know, what's the difference between the two?
Well, the climate crisis of it all just signifies that things are moving pretty rapidly, faster than we anticipated, and we really need to do something about it. When we're in crisis, we raise our hands and we call for help, and the planet's calling for help.
And that's why you do what you do. So what does the climate crisis look like in our state?
So North Carolina is getting warmer. It's wetter, but we're also seeing dry periods in between those big rainstorms and hurricanes, and also more humid. And as many of us noticed in the past few months, that warm, wet weather combined leads to an early green up and lots of pollen.
Yeah. Has the pollen been around longer than normal?
It's been more robust than normal. We set some records this year for our pollen counts, and I certainly felt it.
Well, I wonder if that means just more spraying down porches and cars or if more people have actually gotten sick.
I think some folks are suffering. I'm seeing folks take out Claritin and Allegra during meetings and tissues. And I know I had to stock up, but also my white car was yellow for a few months.
Well, so what are some of the other noticeable or just really undeniable signs that we're in a crisis?
So we have this coastline, and we love visiting it, but we are seeing sea level rise on our coast. There's water in places that wasn't there before, and we're seeing what we call sunny day flooding. So there isn't a storm, there isn't rain, but there will be water on the street because of tidal flooding. So warm water just takes up more space, and the ocean's taking up more space on the land where it didn't before.
Do you think because we're in North Carolina— or we're in the South, and we're just used to bad weather, we're used to hurricanes, we're used to actually having seasons. So we know there's going to be change. But I wonder if folks out there are really taking all this seriously, or it's just like what we expect because of where we're located.
Well, these past few weeks in April have been really warm, and folks are noticing that it's in the high 80s, and we aren't even in summer yet. So people are having that conversation. People are noticing that. When we get rainstorms and it's maybe 3 or 4 inches of rain, people are saying, huh, that's bigger or more rain than it happened before. But also with the sunny day flooding and the sea level rise, there's water in places where we didn't have it before. So I think people are really tuned into the changes. And we saw a lot of this after Hurricane Florence. It was so big and so destructive that people started saying, this isn't normal.
So are you able to speak on like overall, our overall health and wellness, you know, not just of the environment when we think of how, you know, changes in climate, you know, has really impacted us?
Yeah, and it certainly impacts people. And I almost like to talk about that more than just an environmental issue because we're motivated by saving our family, our friends, our neighbors, ourselves. And we are seeing increased health impacts, mental health and anxiety because of climate change. So when you're talking about a crisis that's looming, certainly young people can get very anxious and scared about that. We're also seeing more incidents of asthma. I talked about the allergies earlier, but women also suffer, pregnant women also suffer in warmer temperatures and sometimes have preterm labor because of that. So we're all tied to the environment that we live in. And when the planet's unhappy, people are unhappy too.
And that's when we, you have to bring up our mental well-being. Definitely. You know, we're a few months from peak hurricane season in this state. What are some early predictions for the season? I mean, some of this rain and wind just in the past, like you say, a couple of weeks, I was like, this feels like a hurricane, but I know the season hasn't started yet.
Yeah, the season hasn't started yet, but early predictions aren't looking good. The forecasts are showing a really active Atlantic hurricane season, but here in North Carolina, we know it just takes one. So even if we have a really active season and the hurricanes miss North Carolina, we luck out a little bit, and we have lucked out a bit these past few years. But thinking back to Hurricanes Matthew and Florence, they're still in recent memory. People are still recovering from them. We have people who are still not back in their homes following these hurricanes. So having another one come in would be a compound disaster.
So you're relatively new to this area. Maybe you can talk about
5 years.
5 years. And so for listeners like you who haven't really experienced hurricanes, for example, or the weather that's on the way, you know, how would you advise them to prepare?
Yeah, so I have not grown up in a place with hurricanes, and I actually did a lot of my research.
I was born during a hurricane. I won't tell you which one, because then you can calculate my age, but yeah, I'll just put it that way.
Yeah, so I moved to North Carolina, and we had, I think it was Hurricane Dorian right after I got here. And I got my kit together, I got my resources, I put gas in my car, and it wasn't even supposed to do much in Raleigh, but I was thinking, you know, about the bigger picture. But for our friends on the coast, they've been through hurricanes and they know what it's like. And not everybody has the luxury of getting up, driving inland and staying in a hotel for weeks on end or who knows how long. So we encourage folks to prepare, have a strategy. Know when you do need to get out, have supplies on hand, have water on hand, you know, have other sources of energy, and just also check on your neighbors. We need each other during these times.
Well, you know, summer is also right around the corner. You know, that's when we know hurricane season is here. But can we expect record temperatures again this year? It's been pretty hot. Actually, we've been in the high 80s already.
We've been in the high 80s already, close to 90. You know, if I didn't know that it was April, I would think that we were in June. We only had a few record temperatures last summer, and I like to tell people it wasn't record, it was relentless. It was just above normal for for so many days. And we felt it. We had to turn on our air conditioning night after night. You know, certainly I adjusted my activities to not do things at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I would go out and do my exercise at 6 a.m.
That's what I was going to say. Maybe you can give us some more recommendations of really how to keep safe when the heat is striking down hard.
Yeah. So notice the signs of heat stress and fatigue. Keep water on you. Get to shade. Get to cool spaces if you can. Don't push it. I think one of the things that we see in North Carolina is that it's hot. It's always been hot. It's going to be hot. It will be hot in the future. But it's just that much more hotter that people are going out and doing what they used to do and getting sick. I think we also need to be cognizant of what we're asking other people to do. Maybe they're working outside in really unsafe conditions, or maybe we're holding a sports practice at a time that could be readjusted.
Well, I'm here with state climatologist Dr. Kathy Dello, and I guess we're talking about heat right now, but also something that's very new. You said for the first time that I guess your office is releasing a heat toolkit. Is this going out to municipalities, or tell me about this toolkit?
Yeah, in conjunction with Earth Day, we are releasing a heat planning toolkit for local governments. And this is in partnership with the North Carolina Office of Resiliency and Recovery and the Department of Health and Human Services and a number of other partners. And this is taking the data and moving it beyond you and I talking about it being hot and giving local governments some tangible actions about what they can do for people in heat. We're really good at planning for flooding. We see it. It's a very acute disaster. But heat's the silent killer. It truly kills more people than any other weather related event.
Is this something that municipalities ask for? What else could we find? What else could they find in this toolkit to make sure they can help the citizenry?
Yeah, so they will find ways to identify vulnerable populations, ways to communicate to them about the heat. So again, people think that North Carolina's hot and maybe are doing what they need to do. Tips for locating cool spaces or activating cooling shelters, but also data and thresholds and alert systems that they can access to know that maybe the heat is unsafe that day.
What is unsafe? I mean, I know they say it's the humidity and not the heat, but since we live where there's heat and humidity, I just wonder, you know, what should we be looking for?
Well, it varies from person to person, but also by different groups and different ages. So certainly the elderly population is more susceptible to heat than some younger folks. But also there are a lot of people who live in energy poverty or don't have energy security. And those are a lot of our low-income communities of color. They may not have cooling or may not be able to afford to turn on their cooling. So they may be exposed to warmer and hotter temperatures day after day after day. And the body builds up that stress and doesn't forget it. So then going outside into a major heat wave would stress them more than someone who has been in and out of cooling. And certainly people who are on certain medications react to heat differently. And also, as we saw last year when we had that terrible air quality, we all reacted a little bit differently to what was happening with the air quality and how we felt with it. And it's the same with the heat.
I know I find myself, you know, of course, listening to the radio, but also watching the meteorologists on TV. And they usually have some coding going on, you know, like the temperature will be high, the humidity will be high. It's a special alert, you know. Don't go outside this time of day. So are we talking about, you know, everything over 90?
No. So a lot of the alerts come from NOAA's National Weather Service, and we share a building with them at NC State University, which is a really nice arrangement. But they will look at things like the heat index, which is a way that we essentially calculate how bad it feels outside. Some people have called it the real field temperature, but really when we look at that number and it's something like 105 or 107, we know it's a day to stay inside. So they'll base their alerts off of that, but the heat index is calculated in the shade, so it can be even worse in the sun.
Mm. So not, because I can't recall our temperature getting that high, but it could feel that hot.
It could feel that high, yes.
So how does your department, you know, help farmers, for example, you know, gauge the impact of climate change, you know, on their crops and have to also think of workers?
Yeah, so farmers are some of the most tuned in to the weather and climate patterns beyond the folks in my office who are looking day in and day out of the data. They know that the temperature swings back and forth. We've been talking with folks for the past few months about our early bloom and early green up, but also the potential of, you know, another freeze coming in, which we haven't had in Raleigh, but, you know, we're still not out of the woods there yet. But we work with them to understand how many growing degree days have accumulated with their crops and how they've developed over time, what things may look like in the future. So projections of climate in North Carolina, what crops may thrive in a different North Carolina. But I would say the agricultural industry is very tuned into this. I mean, when you think about your business being impacted directly by the weather, folks are looking at how they may adapt.
It makes me think about, I guess, our flagship crop, you know, one of the sweet potatoes, for example. Any specific crops have been affected with our rising heat?
Well, we're seeing a lot of adaptations. So like I said, when your bottom line is impacted by weather and climate, you figure out how to make it work. But with things like climate change, we're seeing new pests and diseases come into the state that maybe we didn't have before. So maybe different operations around spraying pesticides, maybe different planting patterns. Right now, this period of dry weather that we're having is actually really good because folks can get in the fields and plant the crops. We've got our Christmas trees, we've got our sweet potatoes. We're looking at all of it, and it's all tied to the weather and climate.
I'm thinking about those who fish for a living. You know, they do that probably year round. You know, how is climate change impacting the fishing industry and even the fishing hobbyists around here?
So the water temperatures, especially off our coast, are warmer than they have been. And I've heard people talk about catching things off our coast that they hadn't before off of North Carolina, or the things that they expected to catch were actually off the coast of New Jersey. In our creeks and streams, I'm not especially familiar with what's happening with the fishing there, but I'm sure it's similarly impacted.
So the effects of climate change, it seems irreversible, for example. I mean, once you have to change the way you farm, the way you live, the way you eat, the way you farm, I mean, that's just the way of life now, right?
We're in a different North Carolina, and we will be in a different North Carolina, but there's still time to change the track we're on. So I like to tell people, when you fall asleep on the bus and you've missed your stop and you wake up, you don't just continue on the bus until the very last stop. You get off as soon as you can. And we've fallen asleep on the bus, but not just North Carolina, the entire planet. And we need to get off the bus and change the track that we're on. But also, these adaptations that we're making, I think, are also a little bit hopeful. We know as humans, we know as Americans, we know as North Carolinians how to thrive, how to take care of each other, and how to live when things get tough. This is one of our biggest challenges as humanity, but we faced big challenges before.
You've devoted your entire career, it seems, to climate study. Are you optimistic? You know, what keeps you that way if you are?
I have to be. I really got into this, though, because I love weather and I just wanted to be a meteorologist. And turns out we actually have a global crisis on our hands. But I'm optimistic because of the people that I work with, the people that I interact with every day, the community members in North Carolina who just want good things for their families, good things for their friends, good things for the people that they live around. And I think it's truly special. I think there's so much that's special about this state, the sweet potatoes, the mountains, the coast, everything that we've talked about, and that it's worth saving.
And I guess just, you know, what do we say, or what do you say to individuals who feel like maybe this crisis is bigger than just one person's efforts? You know, how can we all just stay encouraged?
We all matter. And one of the best things that you can do is talk to people about climate, talk about your fears, but also talk about your hopes. I think about this all the time. It's my job, but most people do not. Most people aren't even talking about climate on a day-to-day basis. So talk with your friends and family about it. Get involved at the local level. That's where change happens. We cannot wait for big federal policy to happen. It has to happen in our communities, and that's where it does.
And, you know, and lastly, as a climatologist, how far in the future can you forecast?
So our models are looking out to 2100, 2200. But at that point, they're not saying on this day, 100 years from now, this will be the weather, but rather projecting trends. And they're all saying warmer. They're saying wetter for the Carolinas. And they are giving us, you know, some guidance. But we don't know what's going to happen on a certain day 50 years from now. But we know that we're stacking the deck with more rainfall, higher temperatures, stronger hurricanes. We know that winter will still happen, but we're seeing more of those warmer winters sneak in. So we can start to hedge toward a specific answer.
Well, happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day.
Thank you for being with me today. Dr. Kathy Dello is state climatologist at the North Carolina State Climate Office.
Thank you for having me.
Well, next up, we'll check in with Charles Welch, conservation coordinator at the Duke Lemur Center, about efforts to protect one of the Earth's most endangered mammals. You're listening to Due South. Welcome back to Due South. I'm Leonita Inge. One of the most endangered groups of primates on the planet can be found right here in Durham, North Carolina. Just make your way to the Duke Lemur Center, where you'll be able to visit more than a dozen species of these majestic mammals and learn all about how they are bred, fed, and rescued. I'm here with someone who's done more than his part to prevent the extinction of lemurs. Dr. Charles Welch is the conservation coordinator at the Duke Lemur Center. Dr. Welch, welcome to Due South. And I really want to call you Charlie. Is that okay?
Please do. I'm not a doctor anyway.
Well, you do a fantastic job at the Lemur Center. And I've seen you at work there, and we're just really glad to have you here, really in honor of Earth Day. The work you do is so closely aligned, like, to the mission of conservation, and we'll talk more about the specifics of that in a moment. But first, you know, I'd love for you to tell us some basic facts about lemurs, you know, starting with their history in Madagascar, you know, where you lived for many years along with your wife. And why aren't lemurs found anywhere else in nature?
Well, thank you for having me, Leonita, and I'm happy to be here. And lemurs are really, really unique animals, and their whole story is a very unusual, remarkable story. It goes back, going way back, Madagascar, as we know it today, broke away from Africa about 180 million years ago. But it's been drifting for years, and for about 80 million years, Madagascar has been exactly where it is today, which of course is very important in terms of species of animals because it's been so isolated for so long. The lemurs, for example, which are descended from an ancestral lemur that only existed 60 million years ago on the African continent, actually got over to Madagascar. The leading theory is that they drifted across on mats of vegetation from the African continent to Madagascar, and that in and of itself is a pretty remarkable story to think that that could possibly even happen. But when I say drifted across on vegetation, think about something like a tsunami washing inland and washing out pieces of forest, trees, vegetation, or maybe a storm. But in any case, in theory, huge islands of trees washed out into the ocean, and on some of those trees were ancestral lemurs that were able to float across to Madagascar. That's part one. Part two is that there were enough of those lemurs to survive once they got to Madagascar and onto the island, and they found enough resources and little enough competition in terms of other mammals that were there that they managed to survive. And so then from that ancestral lemur species that got across the Mozambique Channel, we now have 110 species of lemurs that exist today.
That's amazing. When did you actually feel and learn and just said, you know, there was a need to open the Duke Lemur Center, like that the lemurs, I guess, were not doing as well as you had hoped in Madagascar?
Well, the Lemur Center has been around for over 50 years, I think over 55 years now. And it was started by a man named Jan Butner Janisch. He was the first director, and he was an anthropologist that came down from Yale University. And he, along with Peter Klopfer, who was at the Lemur Center, the two of them started the Lemur Center as a research center, and that's always been our focal interest is research on lemurs. And our other objectives or the other elements of our mission developed years down the road. And by other components or elements, I mean education and then conservation as well.
Well, I guess once families and children found out that the lemurs were there, you kind of had to open your doors a little bit, at least to let them walk the grounds, which is amazing if one has not visited the Duke Lemur Center.
Well, we used to be much lower profile than we are now, and we didn't used to be open to the public.
Right.
We're a little unusual in that respect for a research center. Most primate research centers are just, they focus on research alone, and we felt like we could branch out into other areas.
Well, my children are 23 and 26. I know that's hard for you to believe now. but, you know, when we found out there was a Duke Lemur Center here, when we moved here a long time ago, you know, the boys were like, Zabumafu. We have to see Zabumafu. And for those who don't know who Zabumafu is, it's a lemur that was a part of a very popular program on PBS.
Zabumafu.
It's the Crackpotters.
While walking in the woods one day, Chris and Martin saw something strange. A little leaping lemur who liked to bounce and play.
Was Zabumafu ever at the Duke Lemur Center, the actual lemur?
He was. I'm going to be embarrassed to say that I don't remember his real name, but they actually did filming for some of Zabumafu at the Lemur Center, the parts of the show that were using a live lemur. They also used a marionette, a puppet in the show as Zabu as well.
Yeah, Zabu, I remember.
Yeah.
So how did that program help the Duke Lemur Center? I mean, did it hurt or help? You know, did everybody want to come there then? Because we know the research is very important and very specific. But did it just open the door to maybe young folks who wanted to be a part of your conservation efforts?
Well, I think it helped awareness about lemurs in Madagascar. Most people aren't familiar with Madagascar. More are now, so more because of the animated film Madagascar.
Right.
But yeah, the Zabumafu did play a part in bringing awareness.
Well, I'm here with Dr. Charles Welch. He's the conservation coordinator at the Duke Lemur Center. Earlier, I mentioned how lemurs are just among the most endangered species of mammals on Earth. What are some of the reasons for that?
Well, Madagascar was a French colony, and it became independent in the 1960s. And after independence, they threw their lot with the Soviet Union, and things really didn't go that well. The economy took a nosedive, and that's to say that now and for quite a while, it's been one of the poorest countries in the world. So a lot of people on the island, and there are 28 million people in Madagascar now, and a lot of those people in rural areas are practicing what we call subsistence agriculture. They're just growing enough food to eat. So what that means is, in the using traditional agriculture techniques like swidden, which is just slash and burn, it just means you're cutting forest and burning the dried vegetation. It gives a quick blast of nutrients, of nitrogen to the soil, and one crop will grow, maybe 2 years they'll get a crop, but then they have to move on and cut more forest. Well, when you have a country with that many people on the landscape cutting forest and continually cutting forest to grow food, the forest is going to disappear. And so the estimate now is that somewhere around only 15% of the natural forest is remaining on the island. And of course, that natural forest is lemur habitat.
How many lemurs? We know about 12 different species of lemurs are at the Duke Lemur Center in North Carolina, but are you able to say how many lemurs are on the site and how many adults are needed to take care of these lemurs and are actually doing research?
Well, we have 220 lemurs at the Lemur Center currently. It's hard to keep up with birthing season.
That's a big season. Very exciting when a baby lemur is born.
Yeah, indeed.
How many grad students and others are needed to take care of all these lemurs?
We have about, I think, 45 on staff as a whole. Now, in terms of animal care staff, we only have about, I think, 15 that directly are cleaning cages and feeding the animals. But we have research staff as well. We have development staff, education staff. So it all adds up to what we do.
I wonder, you know, when feeding the lemurs, because they're not in Madagascar and they're in North Carolina, I mean, what are they eating here? Are you trying to keep their diets very similar to what they eat in that part of the world? Or are they just eating what we eat here, barbecue, grits? No, we know they're not eating that. But aren't they vegetarians, of course?
Yeah, not much in the way of barbecue, for sure. But we try to duplicate the diets as best we can with the fruits and vegetables that we're able to access. We do feed the nocturnal lemurs, get insects because that's an important part of their diet. And the aye-aye get larvae. And the leaf eaters or folivorous lemurs get leaves every day, and that's very important. And we substitute winged sumac, which is a native plant that they like a lot and is in a plant family that's very common in Madagascar, which those lemurs are eating frequently.
Well, how did you grow your interest for the study of this, you know, of lemurs? You know, why do you love lemurs so much?
I started out working in a zoo when I was in high school in summers, and that's where I really became interested in in animals of all sorts. And I was lucky enough to be able to do that. And then I was also lucky enough to be able to work as a research assistant in different countries while I was in college. So that gave me an exposure to different places, different cultures, different animals, and it was something that I really liked. And my wife and I were both involved in lemur care and husbandry and management. But when there came an opportunity for us to work in conservation in Madagascar, we jumped at that opportunity. And that was really a bit by chance that Madagascar began to open up to Western countries in the mid-1980s into the late 1980s. And that's when programs between the Lemur Center and collaborations between the Lemur Center and Madagascar, the Madagascar government began.
Have you been able to return many lemurs to Madagascar successfully? Is that the goal?
Well, that's not really what we would term one of our conservation goals. The goal is certainly conservation breeding in the sense that we have species as sort of a safety net in case the species went extinct in the wild. But we have reintroduced the black and white ruffed lemur into Madagascar, which was a huge, very ambitious project, even though we only took 13 individual black and white ruffed lemurs back to Madagascar and released in the wild. But it's just incredibly complicated to do that and to do it the right way. It took years of preliminary work beforehand, before we even took animals over, getting proper authorizations, doing research, studying resources in the forest. And it's very expensive as well. And I guess I could say in the end, what we learned mostly from that reintroduction back into the wild was that it really makes more sense to do what's called translocation, which is moving lemurs from a threatened forest fragment in Madagascar to another forest that's in Madagascar that's protected, because those lemurs already know how to look for food. They know what food to eat. And most importantly, probably they're already experts at predator avoidance, mm-hmm. which was a problem that we ran into with the lemurs that we sent back to Madagascar.
Well, it's an amazing story. They're amazing animals. I hate to have to wrap up now because I really want to talk about those lemurs that escaped from the Duke Lemur Center some years ago. But didn't school kids spot them and get them, well, help you all bring them back home? But we won't talk about that. We won't talk about that today. But thank you very much. Dr. Charlie Welch is the conservation coordinator at the Duke Lemur Center. I'm glad you came today.
Thank you, Leonita. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Well, this is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Cole Del Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. For co-host Jeff Tabiri, I'm Leonita Inge.